It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod's Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Hello, my name is Randy Zarnke. I'll be your host for today's edition of our Alaska Tracks program. This program is based on an oral history project conducted by the Alaska Trappers Association. We focused on people engaged in an active outdoor lifestyle such as hunters, pilots, trappers, hunting guides, and wildlife biologists. These interviews were recorded all over the state, which provides the listener with some info that will be quite familiar, but also introduce new places and activities. The project began in 1997 and is still ongoing. There are over 200 recordings in the collection. Today's episode will feature Earl Callahan from Petersburg. Earl is known primarily as a hunter and trapper, but has engaged in many other outdoor activities. This interview was recorded in 2002. In this first section, Earl will describe how he got started in the logging industry down in the lower 48.
Well, I started working in the woods up here, and that's what I did down there in Priest Lake, Iowa, where I met that old Henschel. Walker Brothers was the name of the outfit. One of the truck drivers, he had some kind of woman problem way down Washington State, and he left to go down and get that straightened out, and he never did come back. Stanton Walker, he says, well, let's take the kid and make a double clutcher out of him. I didn't know shit from wild honey, you know. So, by gosh, I rode with Stanton for a trip or two, and then I started hauling logs. They was big logging trucks in those days. They had gas engine, international, 3,000 feet of logs was a big load. The roads were so bad you couldn't haul them any more than that. You just sink the truck and all, you know. So I thought that was big business. And along comes Stanton's dad, and he was the head of McGoldrick Lumber Company, and he says to me, he says, aren't you Bert's boy? And I said, yeah. Well, he says, I know your folks real well. He says, why aren't you in school? You got a job, I'm going to work. Heck, I can work here. And no, you got to go to school. And he come down to the bunkhouse that night, and he told me, he says, you'll either go to school or I'll fire you. I had no choice. And he told me, you go to school, and you can work in here in the logging camp and drive a logging truck as long as you want to. And I was just a kid, you know, that was a big thing then. I finished school, and when I come back, they had bought between the camp and McGoldrick Lumber Company, they had bought three or four brand spanking new Diamond T diesels. Them was real good trucks in them days. That'd be in 1938. Punk and rolling kid like me getting right in a brand new Diamond T diesel, you know. Well, I had that in my shirt pocket when I come to Alaska. You know, I had already served my apprenticeship in the woods on them logging trucks and yarders, so it was no problem for me to get a job around here. In fact, I drove for Valentine Logging Company for the biggest part 25 years in the summertime, and in the wintertime when the camp's down, do nothing, you know, and that'd give you a chance to hunt and trap all you wanted to. Worked out pretty good like that.
Okay, well, that was a great story by Earl. He obviously has a very unique use of the English language. I hope you enjoyed some of those phrases that only come off of Earl. In this next segment, Earl will tell us about a bear encounter he had on the beach down on Prince of Wales Island that you and I would consider quite harrowing, but for Earl, it was just another day at the park.
Well, I lived for the biggest part of 20 years in Admiralty. I never had any real, what you'd call real close encounters. Been a little concerned a time or two. There was only one time that pissed right down my leg, you know, but it turned out all right. Where the tide comes in a salt chuck, and everything crossed there, you know. When the tide is out, they just cross there without even getting their feet wet. And I was over along that where the tide comes in. I thought maybe that ground loose a deer there if one come by. And by gosh, I turned to leave. It was just at evening, and I hadn't seen a thing, maybe a mink or something running off the beach, but I didn't see any bears or no deers or anything. And I had the skiff down the beach a little ways, tied to a tree there. Walked down there, and by gosh, this bear come out of the brush. Oh, it wasn't very far. No great big danger at all. A bear that 100 or 2 yards from me is no threat. I didn't pay much attention to him, you know, and he seen me, and I could tell the way that he was watching that he was pretty interested in what he was seeing there, you know, and that son of a gun just deliberately come right down where the rocks was all washed clean. He stopped and stood up on his hind feet for a second or two, and so I thought, well, I'll kind of discourage him. And I just sat down on one knee. I wasn't even aiming at him. I was real careful that I shot, oh, maybe a foot or two on one side of him in them rocks. And I turned one loose, and I thought that he'd just drop to his feet and run like a deer. You know, it's what I thought. There was no other thought in my mind at all, but that isn't the way it worked. Bang, that H&H went off, and just instantly he dropped to his feet and come just like a racehorse right over to where I was. Pulled up about from here at the road out there, and stopped. Well, I was a little concerned, but I didn't want to kill him. I was talking to him, you know, and I told him, I says, you son of a bitch, you make one more move and I'll kill you. And I got just the equipment to do her with right here, 375 H&H, feeding one of those 350 grain pills. That's big enough to discourage a bear. You know, he kind of acted like a dog. I'm sure that he didn't know what I was talking about, or maybe he didn't even hear me, I don't know, but he walked around there a little bit. My hands were so sweaty that I thought a rifle would slide out of my hand. He pooped around a little bit, went up on the beach there and took a mouthful of old dry grass, and when he did that, I knew that whatever he had in mind, he changed his mind and walked down the beach a little ways, and I went and got the skiff and carried on, but that was the closest that I ever come. He didn't just happen to run in my direction. He knew exactly what he was doing. He might have been an old one because he was kind of brown and darker brown and lighter brown, and then he was almost gray in some places down by his belly. And I never seen him anymore. I'm not saying I could today, but there was a time not so darn long ago that I recognized some of them there. And that's the only time I seen that one. But he don't know how close did he come of getting a 350 hard-nosed Hornaday right between the cookhouse and the bunkhouse.
Well, that was another great story from Earl. In this next segment, he describes how a friend was injured in a boating accident and how the friend developed a humorous fabrication to replace the real story.
A friend of mine, Merle Passenger, he was an engineer in the days before they had this Coast Guard and they had the lighthouse tenders. And he was engineer on lighthouse tender. He was a good storyteller. He was a bullshitter from way back. He'd tell you a story he knew was alive, as you damn near tempted to believe him anyway, you know. And he had the awfulest looking arm that you'd ever seen. His arm was just a horrible looking thing. Scars and what happened, they would barn over an old gas engine in one of those lighthouse tenders. An old gas engine, probably a Standard or Lathrop or something in them days. And it hiccuped and backfired, you know how they do, you know. And they had the bar and the flywheel, and the bar and the, you know, went over. They didn't get it out of the hole in the flywheel. You know how you bar them engines over, or do you? There's holes in the flywheel, and you stick a bar in there, and you bar that engine over until it's in a firing position to start it. Well, something went gunny-sack, and it hiccuped and backfired with the bar in the flywheel. And that bar hit Merle on the arm. Jiminy Christ, you know, it's just terrible. No medical. They just put it back together the best way they could and wrapped something around it to hold it together, you know, and it just healed up like that. But if somebody didn't know, I've heard him tell the same story when him and another guy was wintered up in Taku Harbor up there, and he said they had could see some goats up there. They decided that they'd go up there and get a goat. If somebody didn't know, I've heard him tell the same story when him and another guy was wintered up in Taku Harbor up there, and he said they could see some goats up there. They decided that they'd go up there and get a goat, and so they did. They went up on the side hill up there and shot a goat, and he was telling how tough that goat was. He said, we tried to bake it, tried to fry it, tried to boil it and everything. He said that doggone goat was so tough, so they decided they'd grind it in the meat grinder. He was telling how they'd grind it, and the meat grinder backfired and hit him in the arm. Now, that's a tough goat. That's how his arm got in such a hell of a shape. The meat grinder backfired.
I can't help but laugh at Earl's stories. He's a great storyteller. Not only his content is funny, but his delivery is absolutely top-notch. In this next segment, He talks about hunting for deer to put meat on the table. Of course, there will be a couple of chuckles along the way.
How about deer hunting? I'm sure you shot a bunch of deer over the years.
Oh, I've seen a set of tracks drop there a couple of times. Sure, a guy would get deer once in a while. Now, you understand, I live there, you know, the year round. You know, when we got low on meat, it didn't make any difference what month it was or anything like that. Well, I'd roll a deer over. But I don't think that we ever eat more than maybe three or four deer in a year. With king salmon and halibut and a few shrimp, the guy don't just gorge up on meat every day, you know. I was getting down pretty low on meat, you know, and there wasn't any deer moving, that kind of weather, and that north wind, and everything froze up like an Eskimo turd, you know. It come along a day, kind of a medium day, you know. It was a little windy, but it was so much better than it had been that we took the skiff and dressed up pretty warm, and there was a niche back up above the keyhole with trapping in there. Went up into that niche, and I figured that there'd be some deer in there out of that weather because you're pretty well protected from that north face, and there's a lot of bear grass along in that old growth spruce up there close to the beach. And we got up there and then just slid in there. It's a kind of a steep bluff. Hadn't gone very far, and look at right there. There's just what we're looking for. So I got a rock between me and that deer, put the outboard in reverse and just back up, keep that rock between me and him, just idled along there and pulled out so I could see him, and bang, down come one deer. And it, like I say, it's a pretty steep bluff. And I said, well, instead of crawling up that bluff, I said, it's nice enough weather. I said, let's go around that point, and after we get around there, it's not so steep, and I'd rather drag him that far than to come down that steep bluff with him. And so I did. We went up there, and I went on the ground. She tended the skiff, backed it off, and I walked up there to where I'd shot the worst old spawned out buck there was on Admiralty Island. He was ancestors to hundreds of deer, and the meat was just as red as a strawberry, tough. But while I was walking over to them, I walked right through about five or six does and yearlings. Shot that first one I seen, you know. We went home, and it was a little bit froze solid, you know, and we'd whack off a quarter and bring them in the house, thaw them out, cut them up in pieces, and start the meat grinder and grind that old boy up. We eat them right down to the tail feathers. They taste good, but if it without a meat grinder, you'd never eat him.
You've been listening to Earl Callahan as part of our Alaska Tracks program. We're going to take a break now, go to commercials, and we'll be back and with more of Earl's great stories. Welcome back. We're here with Alaska Tracks, and today's guest is Earl Callahan. I remember my dad talking about a deer that was so tough you had to use a knife to cut the gravy. Sounds like Earl got almost that bad. In this next segment, Earl talks about constructing a little shelter known as a cubby to house a mink trap. He offers great detail, so even the non-trappers in the listening audience should be able to visualize his methods. He then shifts gears to talk about his interactions with one of the fur buyers in Southeast.
What kind of a set would you use for mink?
Cubbies made out of rocks. A guy by the name of D. Anderson showed me how he did it, and he was awful successful, and I did it just like him. Didn't need nothing but just a trap. No wire, no sticks, no nothing. Just a trap and piece of salted bait. Make the cubby where the tide before had left a little puddle, you know, of water. In that puddle that's not froze, you put trap down and get a couple of flat rocks and build a little house right over that puddle. Put trap in the puddle, just break off a stick and run it through the trap chain up over the roof on the rocks on the covey, and put another rock on it for a roof. Have the entrance to it away from the tide, so if the wind was blowing a little splash up there when the tide was in, it wouldn't fill the door up with popweed. The tide goes out, well, as the tide is falling, they're out there hunting all the time anyway. And you come along and smell that fish in that cubby. Well, D used salted bottom fish, like old little codfish and stuff, that you do rockfish of all sorts. I think any kind of fish and bait. I've even caught them with just cod liver oil, no bait at all. When they're in that water that way, minks has to be moving to stay warm all the time. As soon as they stop, they die quick, and they'll die right away in that water.
How many would you catch in the average year?
55, 60 mink were targeted at it, something like that.
How big of an area were you trapping over?
I'd say probably two strips of beach, 4 miles long apiece, so it'd be about 8 miles overall, and we looked after them with a skiff. A lot of days, if we went together, if the tide was on the fall, well, you can't just leave your skiff and go up there and fool around with a trap. It'll go dry, and you'll have a hell of a time to get the skiff off a load of stuff you carry for trapping. So one of us would stay in the skiff, another would tend to the trap.
Now, who was your fur buyer? Where would you market your furs?
Right here at the Tides Inn Hotel here in Petersburg. The buyer was Goldberg out of Seattle.
And so you would come in when you knew he was going to be in town?
Yeah, and after I told him once and told him where we lived, well, he'd send out a card and say that he's going to be in such and such a place at such and such a time.
Now, when all you guys would come in from out in the various little places to sell, I imagine there were a few stories exchanged and maybe even a beverage or two.
Yeah, it wouldn't be possible, all right. You know, I got a story, just a little short story, you know. One time, well, it would be between Hobart Bay and Windham Bay along in there. Ruth had a couple of coveys up a creek in there, and so I took her in there with the skiff. There was a little bit of snow on the ground, and she come out. She said, I've never seen anything like this in my life. She had a marten that it was just the color of a Palomino horse, light golden color, you know. Everybody come along, she'd have to show them that marten, and they said, well, hell, you can't sell that because you'd have to have two or three. You know, they wouldn't buy just one of that color, you know. So we come in right here in Petersburg with these furs. We had the old 50 or 60 marten, and just kind of as an afterthought, she put that bond one in a sack and put it in the bunch and brought it in. And we went up there at night. He got down on the floor and was grading them furs. You know how they do it. He opened that sack and took that yellow one out of there, you know, and he looked at it and turned it all over and throwed it to one side. He wasn't saying a thing. He was a quiet guy anyway. And I thought, well, hell, they was right. He didn't want that. He threw it clear over by the end of the bed where he was sleeping there in the hotel room. He got all through figuring on his pad there, 10 marten, and average this, and 20, average this. And he handed me this little slip out of his little notebook there. He says, well, this is what I've come up with. That marten is laying there. Give Ruth $110 for it. I about fell off bed there. And so I handed it to her, and she looked at the total because we already had figured out between us what we thought would be a fair price for him, and he matched that and then some. So we wasn't complaining about the price. We was talking about, you know, everything afterwards. And he said, I want to ask you, where did you get that canary? He said, you told me you was trapping over on the mainland in the neighborhood of Windham Bay. I said, well, yeah, you're not trying to tell me that I lied to you, are you? And, no, no, he says, I believe you. But he says, if I had to guess, I'd guess that that marten come from the Grayling or Keltag or someplace in there. He says, there's the odd one like that in that country. Well, I said, that isn't where it come. It come right off the little creek between the Rock Garden and Hobart Bay. Give $110 for the thing. It was the oldest hide we had.
Now, what kind of prices would you get for your other ones?
Oh, I think that particular time I'm talking about, now I understand that I could be wrong because these old brains are over 80 years old, you know. It just kind of seems to me that that year there was like a $41 average.
In this last segment, Earl describes how he learned to hunt seals. He also explains selling the hides and his favorite part of the seal to eat.
You ever hunt for seals?
Yeah, when they was a market on seals here, you know, a few years ago, I would say it was about 60. There was an outfit from Holland buying seal in this country here. And there was a seal skin buyer named Zinn, and me and a guy named Sam Griffin from Ketchikan. He's not with us anymore either. And him and me, we shot quite a few seals. At that time, I was living there in Ketchikan, and we hunted up Beam Canal. And an old fellow named Rastus Brown hunted seals for years up on the Alatak River and up in that country. And him and Bob Hartley was real professional seal hunters. And he helped me an awful lot. Seals is easy to hunt if you know how.
What's the method?
Just going by Rastus Brown, and by God, I'll tell you, Rastus Brown probably shot as many seals in his day as anybody. A 220 Swift was his favorite one to shoot seals with. Now, when I hunted seals, I had a 222 Magnum. We hunted up around Submarine Rocks and up in Spacious Bay and Murder Cove. There isn't hardly anything to it. You just follow a few simple rules like Rastus had laid down. See them seals on a rock out there. See, there might be 10. Rastus would be sure to get 9 of them. Now, I wouldn't say that I could do that, but maybe come close. Sometimes you're kind of lucky. The thing is, he'd idle up there with a skiff or just rowing in them days. Row up there and them seals, they didn't actually pay you all that much attention if you didn't do something to scare them. Walk right over there and throw rocks at them, anything to get them in the water. Scare them off of there, and then be real careful. It might take you half an hour or more. Maybe the biggest part of an hour to get some. And one guy has got to be there with a skiff to get them, and another guy shooting. You don't shoot if there's more than one up. If there's two got his head out of the water, and you know damn well there's 5 or 6 seal out there, but the other one's under the water, don't shoot. You wait until there's only one and you're sure there's just one. Pop his head up and bang. And it depends on what they're eating. A lot of them float, you know. Some of them don't, but a lot of them do. And the guy in the skiff can get them. And those other ones that's underneath, they didn't hear that, you know. They don't know nobody shot. And another one or two or maybe three will come up. Don't shoot. If you have to, scare them down till there's only one. And you can round out there with that bunch of seals and get them all. Now that's according to Rastus Brown.
And the reason for waiting until there's only one up is that if there's two up and you shoot one,
you'll never get the other.
They'll scare them all away.
A lot of them will go with that one too, or maybe all of them will go. If they don't know what's going on, the only one that knows actually what's going on, he can't tell the others too late. Like if seals from here out across the road.
75 yards or so.
Oh, something like that. That's kind of an average shot of that or closer. I have shot at a seal and looked around and thought that I missed because there's another one. Well, it's a different seal because you just come up. Rastus and Bob Hartley, hell, they hunted up there in Halitak and the Yahtzee River too.
And you would sell the furs and get the bounty?
At that time, they had a hassle to get that bounty that we just got the
fur value.
Got the fur value. But once we had, I don't remember how many it was, but we got an $18 average on them.
You would sell the furs and get the bounty?
At that time, it was such a hassle to get that bounty that we just got the fur value. But once we had, I don't remember how many it was, but we got an $18 average on them. Fella showed me how to skin a seal that you wouldn't believe. He was a native guy, nice guy, one of the nicest guys you'd ever want to meet. Take a seal and just open them up, have it 4x8 sheet of plywood, lay it right up on the bulwarks on the boat. You dress them down until it's just much of the hide loose. They want quite a bit of fat on them because it'd keep the skin during the time that they're shipping them between here and Holland. But you take and lay that skin over on that piece of plywood and put a piece of wood on there and tack it down. Here lays that seal on that incline. Well, he naturally wants to roll. Heck, I bet you there's a lot of them with 250, 300 pounds, you know. You just start slicing and he'll roll. They'll just roll himself right out of the blanket. I know that some guys skin them with a winch and all that bullshit. I don't go for that if I can't do it without power. I don't do it, but me and Sam skinned a lot of them. Sam was good at it. Thought about eating some of the meat. It looks good and everything, but I never did. I never did ever eat any of the meat, but I've eaten my fair share of seal liver, I'll tell you that. First thing, you'd have to like liver. If you like liver, seal liver is without a doubt the best liver on earth. And another thing about a seal, you take just an ordinary seal, maybe only weigh 150 pounds, got a liver in her like a 4-year-old steer. It resembles, to me, chicken gizzards, only it's not near as tough. It even smells a little bit like chicken gizzard to me, but then everything don't smell same to everybody. Now, coffee, to me, I haven't drank a cup of coffee in 75 years. You know, it smells just like a new tire. A rubber tire ain't something that you'd want to drink.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's episode of Alaska Tracks. I hope you enjoyed listening to these great stories. If you'd like to read about more of these great old-timers, there is a book available from the Alaska Trappers Association, which contains 30 of the best storytellers in this collection. The book is entitled Alaska Tracks, the same name as this radio program. You can order it from the Trappers website, which is www.alaskatrappers.org. And tune in again next week at this time for another walk down memory lane.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod Saw Shop. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.